Good afternoon. I will now call this meeting to order of the Senate Resources Committee. Let the record reflect it is 3:32 p.m. on Monday, April 25th, 2022. Let the record also reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. We have Senator Gary Stevens, Senator Natasha Von Imhoff, Senator Kawasaki, and Senator Keel. I can say your first names too. I just didn't mean to leave them out. And myself, Senator Michicki. Staffing today are Indy, and at this time I'd like to remind everyone to turn off or silence your cell phones. Today's agenda consists of three items: consideration of the governor's appointments for Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, Glenn Hyatt, and Senate Bill 133 and Senate Bill 229. You'll hear more about them in just a moment. Today we'll begin with the governor's appointees, Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, Glenn Hyatt. Mr. Hyatt, if you could please come forward, put yourself on the record, give us a brief description about your background, and please tell us why you're interested in serving.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Resource. For the record, my name is Glenn Hyatt, and I've recently been appointed to the second commissioner position with the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, and I'm seeking the legislature's confirmation of that appointment. In opening, I'd like to thank Governor Dunleavy for the appointment and also Director Hardy Enright of Boards and Commissions for helping shepherd the appointment through. A bit about myself: I'm a lifelong Alaskan, born here in Juneau, raised out in Ock Bay, about 12 miles north of here. Went off to school and got a couple of business degrees, a Bachelor of Business Administration and a Master of International Management. In 1995, I worked for the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, serving as oversight for the Western Alaska CDQ program, the Community Development Quota Program. That's an offshore ground fishing and crab economic development program, and we served as an oversight. We helped review investment decisions. We made allocation decisions for the CDQ groups and advocated for the program in policy arenas. In 2001, I worked for the Department of Commerce as a fisheries development specialist, working extensively with the salmon industry. At the time, you may recall, farm salmon was starting to dominate the market, and so we helped the salmon industry quite a bit at that time. Worked in other state fisheries as well, and got a taste of a lot of the fisheries around the state. Quite an interesting time. Did a lot of program development work and implementation during that time. Dealt with a lot of economic information, and of course there was a lot of outreach and collaborative efforts with partners in various areas. In 2007, started working with the university's Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program as a fisheries business specialist. They had a fish biz program, and I helped coordinate that. But that was a lot of a technical assistance for the commercial harvester. A lot like what you see with Cooperative Extension. We'd develop training platforms and put those on. We'd do publications, a lot of technical assistance, one-on-one work with the commercial harvesters. Returned to Commerce back in 2011 and worked as a development manager. And basically, I helped supervise my old job there, but also worked with the other sector specialists in minerals and tourism, forestry, small business development. And actually, the film credit tax program was there at the time, too. In 2013, I started working for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game as the executive director for the Alaska Board of Fisheries, where I've worked for the last 3,150 days. So in that capacity, really, we're there to help support Alaska's fish and game regulatory process, helping the public understand it and working with the department, and, of course, supporting the board as much as we can. So in summarizing this work history, I think it's helpful in terms of Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. I have at least a basic familiarity with almost all of Alaska's commercial fisheries, and in some cases, quite extensive. I've been exposed to sort of the macro and microeconomics of the fishery, whether it's a big sector and what its economics are like, or whether it's an individual operator. I've had an opportunity to review those things. And I think I've got a pretty rich contacts with the industries themselves, with local government officials, and with in the policy arena. So those are very helpful, I think. In terms of management style and work habits, I tend to lean towards collaboration and communication. I've got a pretty strong background in program development and implementation. I'm familiar and used to reaching out to a lot of people, organizing events, and I think those will be helpful. In terms of administration, I tend to move towards developing strong processes to help guide an organization. I think that could be helpful here. As it relates to CFEC, there's been a lot of discussion lately about what a commissioner does, what's the workload. I'll answer that in two ways. The first way I'd answer it is, right now there's at least starting next week, I believe if my count's right, there'll be six of 19 positions that aren't filled. And so job one is to get those filled. So I want to, by mid-May, I'd like to see those jobs posted and have people in those positions by the end of June. At least that would be a goal I'd put to us. I need to study. Even though the workload is down quite a bit in terms of some of the ministerial functions, there will still be appeals that rise to the commissioner level. We'll look at modifying licensing fees. There will continue to be permits to limit fisheries, as well as requests to conduct optimum studies. And so there's a lot of court cases that go to that. There's a lot of statutes and regulations I need to learn about. And, of course, any internal policies I'd like to get a handle on. Need to get my arms wrapped around this Cook Inlet Net study. It's been going on for a while. I don't know where exactly that's at, but I understand it's complicated. But we all know it is. But I want to get involved with that and get something out to people that they can chew on here by the end of the year. That would be important. To the extent practical, I'd like to establish at least some public-facing policies for how we'll deal with permits to limit fisheries and to conduct optimum number studies. I understand that there's a petition to limit a fishery really is asking for regulatory change. And the Administrative Procedures Act says that the agency needs to deny that within 30 days or act on it. But you can't act on limiting a fishery within 30 days. So what are the steps that CFPC is going to take in order to pursue those permits and give some certainty to the public when they submit them? And then I will also be working on developing a fall and winter outreach program, because I really do think this position needs to be out in forums and talking to people, engaging with the fleets, engaging with local government officials to figure out what they need us to do. So that'll be what I'll do right away. Second, I'd like just to speak a little bit about the next phase of CFPC, what is it going to do. It's been a transformative agency over the years, starting in the 70s through 2000, limiting fisheries. It's created a lot of stability, commercial fleet. It's helped create a professional class of fishermen, and that's been very good. But there are some areas that we need to look at. There's been an outfight of permits in some parts of Alaska, not everywhere. Some communities have actually done quite well. But to the extent that there's been an outflight in certain areas, what is the role of CFPC? I'd like to explore that with people and understand if there's something structural that should be done, or if it's really just a matter of engaging and helping people along. There's also an aging workforce in the commercial fishing industry, and that's not a bad thing necessarily. It's created a professional class of harvesters, but the industry does need to reinvent itself. And we want young people to come in, be aggressive and competitive and innovative. We want that. We want them to be able to buy into it, and we also want to give folks that have been at it for a long time the liquidity events so they can retire and move on to the next phase of their life. So, to the extent CFPC is, it serves as a gatekeeper to entry into the industry. And so I want to sort out what the role is, whether it should be formal, really just continuing to engage and help promote young people getting into the fishery. I should stop there, and if you have any questions, happy to try to field them, and thank you again for your consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Haight. Right? Did you say that right?
Yeah.
Questions? Yes, Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Haight. Clearly, you're well qualified for this, so you've had a lot of experiences. And I just relate, when I first got to Kodiak, at Alaska in 1970, a lot of people my age came up to Alaska. They were very successful fishermen, worked very hard. But now it's quite an older fleet, and the problem seems to be to get young people into it. They don't have the money because they have to make a gigantic investment, and folks aren't leaving, I suppose. So how do you get young people into this industry? How can we encourage that? How can we solve that problem?
Yeah, something that I've thought about a lot, certainly in the capacities at Commerce and also at the Sea Grant Advisory Program. I think there's some things that are going on right now that are very positive. Advocacy events like the Young Fisherman Summit is really important. To the extent more needs to be done with the Department of Commerce's loan program, I'm not sure, but that avails opportunity to people too. The big obstacle oftentimes is the cost, not just the boats and the gear, but the permits. And really, IFQ has become is really expensive, right? And that's a little bit outside of CFPC's realm. It could be that we want to develop programs that allow for like a transfer plan. It's done in farming, where you have an individual farmer who's been at it for a long time. The cost of land doesn't support the revenues you make in a farming operation. So you find someone who's young, perhaps if it isn't your own family, but someone who wants to do it, and you slowly move your assets to that individual through an organized transfer plan that involves estate planning, taxation planning, those kinds of things. I'm not suggesting that's the only answer, but I'm not sure what all the solutions are, but it's important to pursue. The average age has gone from the 80s for permit holders to 41, about 41 years of age. It's increased every year to now about 52 years of age. So, and that might be the right age to have an average age to have a fleet, but maybe we want to find a range and not let it get too high, because then again, folks who've been at it a long time won't be able to sell their assets, and that's a problem too.
Well, thank you for thinking about that. It's a really important issue. You see young people coming out of high school and not much of an opportunity in the commercial fisheries unless they inherit something from their parents. And so anything you can do in that realm would be a real advantage to the communities. Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Haidt, thanks for being here today. Maybe a two-parter. The first would be, you mentioned that there's a significant decrease in the adjudications. We used to call it backlog, maybe workload now. Can you talk to us about the size and scope of that as you understand it? And then the other would be closely related. From its inception until a year ago, I think, maybe a year and a half ago, CFPC always had at least one attorney commissioner to help with those very legalistic, quasi-judicial proceedings, and to sort of manage those from on the panel. That hasn't been the case. You bring a significant and impressive fisheries background, but not that legal background. What is your sense of how the commission's going to make that work?
Yeah, thank you for the question. To the chair, Senator Keel, in terms of the adjudication backlog, I believe they've done a good job clearing through all of that. And I think what you'll see in terms of those, the appeals that go to the commissioner, yeah, again, I'm just citing the fisheries hearing I heard the other day. There is, and those are good numbers, there's 1,800 that went to the initial hearing officer, but I think it was only 30 that were appealed to the commissioner. So not much at all happens in that regard. I mean, there are other functions that the commissioners will deal with that I would term ministerial. Maybe that's not appropriate, so there's not as much. And I think that's just something that I need to kind of understand and see what needs to take its place, if anything. So that's something that I'll definitely be looking at. In terms of legal expertise, you are right. I'm not a lawyer. And what I think you have there is, and it's one of the positions that are down, the adjudication section is down, a law specialist, I believe. I'll make sure of that. But you have talent there, and you have resources to help guide you in that. Including the Department of Law. They would not get involved in day-to-day business, I think, of CFPC. There's enough folks there that can help advise on that. But I would have to rely on them until I became pretty familiar with what the policies are and the legal precedent.
Others? Well, you brought up, Mr. Haidt, you brought up an interesting process called an optimization study about Cook Inlet, but unfortunately, the way the statutes are written, you have no way of producing an optimization study that has any value. You're looking at a fishery the size of Rhode Island, and the only affected area that really has an optimization problem is the size of, the square mileage is smaller than the municipality of Anchorage. And there's no way for you to separate those areas the way our optimization study works, hence a bill that's trying to go through the process. And this isn't about that bill, but it's something you're going to have to look at as we run into more and more issues as larger populations of Alaskans expect larger shares of what was previously primarily commercial fisheries. So you brought that up. I don't want to put you on the spot because that process doesn't work in this case. But are you willing to look at things in the future where we can perhaps give you some statutory support that would allow that kind of division of a administrative area? There will be more issues like this. as, you know, we look at these massive returns in Bristol Bay, yet people don't seem to notice the quantities of lodges that are being built at the same time. So well, it takes a couple of years of challenged returns before you have similar problems in other parts of the state, as we see in many different parts. So what do you think about that? Is that something you're willing to evaluate going forward so that optimization studies could actually have some effect on improving some sort of outcome in the future?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I see what you're getting at. I have had a chance to review, at least cursory review of the bill. Without a map in front of me, you know, reading about the admin areas, I wasn't quite certain what we're getting at, but I think I understand what you're talking about. I mean, I dealt with, there's allocation issues all the time with the Board of Fish, and you're right. It's not just going to happen in Cook Inlet, it's going to happen everywhere. In fact, right now in the NACNIC, there's concern over the number of sport fish operators there. The board developed a subcommittee to deal with that, to look at it anyways. An optimum number study in a macro level isn't terribly effective. They did one on the Bristol Bay Drift, and I think the numbers were the optimum number is between 800 and 1,300. As a range of 500, that tells you nothing. So your thought about, and I think what you're saying is review a smaller area, a smaller geographic space, perhaps that does make sense. And I haven't thought of it much, but appreciate it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay, well, thank you. We're going to take some public testimony. Thank you, Mr. Haidt, for being here today and for your interest in serving. Public testimony is now open. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify on Mr. Haidt's appointment? Seeing no one in the room, is there anyone online? I see two individuals. We'll begin with Tracy Welch. If you
Good afternoon.
Yes.
Can you hear me okay?
Perfectly.
Awesome. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for scheduling today's hearing and thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Tracy Welch and I'm calling today on behalf of United Fishermen of Alaska. United Fishermen of Alaska is the statewide commercial fishing trade association representing 37 commercial fishing organizations participating in fisheries throughout the state and the federal fisheries off Alaska's coast. UFA supports the confirmation of the governor's appointment of Glenn Haidt as commissioner of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. Mr. Haidt has worked in a variety of fisheries development and natural resource policy related roles dating back to the mid-90s. His most recent roles include serving as the development manager with the Alaska Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and as the executive director of the Alaska Board of Fisheries. These administrative roles have provided Mr. Haidt with the opportunity to grow his leadership, management, and communication skills. In addition to Mr. Haidt's proven track record of success in administrative roles, he has knowledge of the different fisheries throughout the state. In his role as the executive director of the Alaska Board of Fisheries, Mr. Haidt has had a front row seat to many of the fisheries issues from around the state that have come before the board. His familiarity with current fisheries matters will be useful when tackling issues that come before CFEC. Glenn is well positioned to be an effective leader and an asset at CFEC. Not only does he possess the proper education and work experience necessary to succeed in the management aspect of the CFEC commissioner role, but his familiarity and history with fisheries issues and his demonstrated ability to work with the public make him well-rounded candidate. For these reasons, UFA supports the confirmation of Glenn Haidt for CFEC. Thank you once again for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Welch. Appreciate your testimony. Next, we have Gary Hollier from Kenai. Mr. Hollier, can you identify yourself for the record and provide your testimony?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Gary Hollier, lifelong resident of Kenai, Alaska. I've been a 50-plus year Eastside set netter commercial fisherman, so I've dealt with the CFEC for a number of years, received an original limited entry permit. I've dealt with Mr. Haidt since he's been on the board with the Board of Fish issues for 5 decades, but Mr. Haidt is always, if he doesn't get back within an hour or two, it's certainly the next day with the information and data you need. And I think he'd be a good CFEC commissioner. As it was brought out, the optimization studies in Cook Inlet are basically worthless. I think Mr. Haidt would be able to think outside of the box. I think he also has to deal with regulations and statutes, but I am a 100% full endorsement of Mr. Haidt, and he's top shelf. So thanks for your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hollier. I see no one else wishing to testify on Mr. Haidt's confirmation. Seeing no further public testimony, public testimony is now closed. So, if there are no further questions of Mr. Haidt, I am ready for a motion.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I move that the following named appointee for the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, Glenn Haidt, be forwarded to a joint session of the legislature for consideration.
Seeing no objection, the motion passes. For the record, in accordance with AS 3905080, a signature on this report does not reflect an intent by any members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions. We are going to sign the paperwork. We'll take a brief at ease. Next, we will take up Senate Bill 133. This is the third time this bill is before the Resources Committee. And the second time this session. Here today, we have Christy Cullis, Chief of Operations, Division of Mining, Land, and Water, to give a brief refresher about what the bill does and answer any member questions. Christy, online. If you'd please put yourself on the record and begin. And then we'll see what kind of questions we have from the committee.
Great. Good afternoon. For the record, this is Christy Cullis, Operations Manager for the Division of Mine, Land, and Water, Department of Natural Resources. Thank you, Chair Majicki and committee members, for the opportunity to provide a quick overview of SB 133, Remote Recreational Site Sales and Permits. SB 133 opens up the department's ability to offer state land for recreational purposes. It would amend portions of the existing remote recreational cabin staking program statutes to increase opportunities for Alaska residents to identify a remote cabin site. It does this by expanding the pool of lands where a person can nominate a staking site to include existing lands classified as settlement, in addition to all vacant, unappropriated, or unreserved lands. It also prescribes a process to be followed by the public and agency when adjudicating a nomination to lease, purchase, or permit use of state land for recreational sites. The bill provides for the commissioner to identify areas where land is properly classified for settlement, publish an annual report on areas suitable for disposal as remote sites, and offer those lands for staking. It also provides Alaskans to nominate land for disposal, establish a 10-acre parcel size that may be staked by an eligible participant while requiring specific information necessary for identifying staked parcels. The commissioner could then approve such disposals at their discretion without a written best interest finding. SB 133 directs the commissioner to establish regulations to implement the program. This process requires the applicant to survey and appraise the site and for the commissioner to set the sale price at fair market value. The next component of the bill would establish a process for leasing a remote recreational site. This process provides a time frame for surveying and appraising sites, as well as a requirement for marking parcel boundaries that allows for an initial 10-year leasing term and two additional 10-year lease renewal periods, while restricting some of the assignments or leasing and allowing for a termination of a lease for noncompliance. This would be a step someone could take to move into sale. The last component of the bill allows for a permit to be issued for a remote recreational site for up to 25 years. This process allows for permits to be revocable at the discretion of the commissioner and may be terminated for any reason, but regulations would need to be adopted to specify the lands eligible for a remote recreational site, and then permit holders may apply to lease or purchase the permitted site during the term of their permits of 25 years. So that concludes my overview of SB 133, and I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. Do we have any questions for Christy? Yeah, Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Christy, just help me here that this is simply does not tie up land that would not be developed. There's a requirement that that a cabin be built. What are the requirements of someone who gets this property?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, we aren't having a prove up of building a cabin for this program. it would be more of moving to the sale of the property by having it surveyed and appraised and then moving it into a contract. And there is a component of the bill that does increase the ability for the state to issue contracts for not just 20 years, but 30 years. So we don't have a prove up of actually building a structure.
Wow, thank you.
Other questions?
Oh, I thought you had.
Senator Keel.
Sure, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This call is we're arguing about who gets to ask the next question. the last time we talked about this bill, we'd had a couple of questions for follow-up, and I have misplaced the answers. I apologize to you for that. The two that I have in my notes were, what is the historic average parcel size for land disposed of this way? But the other was, is there a public notice when a parcel transitions from being permitted to being leased?
One second, please. Let's get a copy of the letter to Senator Keel so that we can. Once we're going to take a brief at ease. Okay, we are back on the record. And Christy, I'll turn it back over to you. You had a question.
All right. Through the chair, Senator Keel. So in regards to the average size of parcels that we have sold since 2001, currently that's sitting at 13.2 acres. So that's from offering of 937 parcels. We've had 807 of those actually purchased, for a total of 10,655 acres since 2001 sold. So that's 13.2 acres. In regards to your question on permitting move to lease, would it go through a public notice? At this time, if it's a nominated site, then that would go in, that would actually go through the process that's listed under the leasing and the sales provisions of the bill. And those would have to go through the public notice if they weren't classified properly. So it kind of depends on the classification of the land. Does exempt the commissioner's list that she put available for lands that could be sold or leased. That is exempt from a best interest finding, but that doesn't prevent us from doing still a public notice. We just wouldn't have to go through that best interest finding as required per statute.
Thanks.
Senator Keel, further questions?
I'll come back to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. So this, through the chair, this remote recreational site updates some existing language to include settlements. What? How much extra land is that term settlements include? Like, does it double the total amount authorized under the current staking permit system, or is it double it? Is it triple it? I'm just trying to figure that out.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, so I don't know if it per se doubles it, but currently our remote recreational cabin staking program, we might have a very large acreage of site, let's say 10,000 acres, but we're only going to allow let's say, 100 people to stake within that area of a maximum of 20 acres. Do you have more of a limitation of the number of people that could go in and stake within that area? So instead, this would open it up to any settlement lands or vacant, unappropriated, unreserved land. So the numbers we haven't completely calculated, and I don't have that in front of me, but I could. I know we've had it in some of the documents we've provided in the past of what BU lands, but there's quite a bit of it. So we would be able to increase the number of people that go out and stake a parcel in the sense of we wouldn't have a limitation on the areas as much as we do now. Right now we write a decision for a specific area with a maximum number of stakers in that area.
So just to follow up, we're not clear as to how much larger the settlement land or the vacant and unappropriated land as far as size goes compared to the current staking program.
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, I just don't have those numbers in front of me at the moment to give to you, but I can provide those to you.
Okay. And then I guess my second question is that we have a bill from Senator Michiki relating to the personal use cabin staking program. There's only 150 people or so left, 150 families, and that was one that predates several, I guess it predates the 50s probably, because I know there's folks that have owned it for many, many years. We have I think we have a trappers staking program up in the next hearing on Wednesday. There's this remote recreational cabin site, and you know, sort of part of the complications between having so many different types of staking is that they have all different sorts of rules. And I guess my not question, but mostly just comment is that, is there a way to do it so it's we don't have all these multiple programs overlapping one another?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, that's a good point. Yes, we do have multiple different types of cabin programs. In regards to the personal use cabin program that you referenced in Senator Michiki's bill, that one is a program from the 80s of cabins that were built on state land without proper authorization. So in the 80s, they offered the opportunity for people to come in and get a permit. So that program then basically closed down, not allowing anyone else to build a private personal structure. So those ones have been in some ways sunsetting since the 80s as people are no longer on the permits. You can't add additional people. They can't transfer them or assign them. So that is a very specific, and that's a permit, so that's a very specific type of authorization for recreational purposes. This bill opens it up and allows individuals to actually come in and now get a permit through us. So even some of these PUCPs holders could come in and actually apply and get a 25-year permit, and then maybe if it's appropriate, move to a lease or a purchase. So it actually opens the doors for your everyday citizen to be able to get a recreational piece of property that maybe they didn't have an opportunity to have before, because we never opened that area up for remote rec staking in the past. In regards to trapping, those are very specific cabins to commercial operators. They have reduced fees because they're doing trapping activities. So we don't charge them quite as much. It's something also that was established, I believe, in the 80s as well, to maintain that certain quality of life for trappers and the way of life. And so that's more for the trapping community. We've had many programs, but they all have a different flavor, and most of them are for commercial purposes, where this bill is more specific to recreational personal use, similar to what PUCPs were when they were established in the 80s.
Just one more. Yeah, and just one more question. Thank you, through the chair. I'm fairly familiar. I introduced a bill similar to this and found out that there were so many problems with it, we just had to let it go. But on the remote recreation cabin staking program, it's fairly prescriptive. And the reason that was explained by the department at the time was because if people were just to stake in really remote areas or random places or vacant and unappropriated areas, and somehow later on it was discovered that, you know, you've got gas or oil leases nearby or access points or right-of-ways that need or within a right-of-way or within even the RS-2477 right-of-way, that cabin might have to be destroyed, I guess, at a future point in time. And I guess I'd like to hear your comments on that, or if that could happen, because again, the Department of Natural Resources does this and has rules that they follow when trying to establish which land is available for the existing remote recreational cabin staking program.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, that's a good question. So that's why we would look at lands that are classified as settlement or vacant unappropriated, because if it does have a mineral classification, those would be lands that we would not include in the commissioner's list of available lands. And also for even permitting, that would be something that we would have to look at, and that's why we would adopt regulations. So we could do that research, also consider our RS-2477s in all easements. And that will be something that when someone was to come to us, let's say to nominate or to say they wanted to develop in this area, we would have to do our due diligence to ensure that there were not any conflicts, higher, better use for the state of Alaska. So that is part of the adjudication process that we would have to go through when individuals would come to us. Same thing with some of these personal use cabins that currently exist. They may qualify for nominating, but there's some that are in legislatively designated areas. And so we would not be able to move to sale for those because it's in an area that cannot be disposed of. So we would have our due diligence by all means, and we would not be able to dispose of lands that did not have a proper classification.
Okay. Yes, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But on that specific point, if memory serves, the bill specifically says the commissioner can reclassify any land at the request of an applicant, right? So what would stop a future commissioner in a future administration with a different philosophy from reclassifying mineral land?
And Christy, could you periodically put yourself on the record? You're the only female voice, but it might be helpful.
Sure. Yes. For the record, this is Christy Collis. I am the Division of Mine, Land, and Water Chief of Operations for the Department of Natural Resources. Through the chair, Senator Keel. So we do have a process required in statute for classifying land. And if we did want to move to reclassification, that would require a finding that would have to go through a process under our statute 3805945. You know, it depends on if the lands are not properly classified, we would still have to go through that classification process, which then goes to public notice and agency notice. It's very prescriptive within 3805945. And so that is the process we would need to follow if we were to looking to classify, and any future commissioner that would be looking to classify lands would need to go through, which also has that appeal process at the end if it was found that those lands were not properly being reclassified.
A follow-up.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you give us you cited, I think, the 3805945 reclassification. The bill specifically says may reclassify under two different statutes, 3804065 and 05300. How do they differ?
Through the chair, Senator Keel. So you are correct. The two statutes that you're seeing there are the classification statutes. And those classification statutes point back to 3805945. So they're classification statutes that we're specifically calling out in the bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Senator Keel. Any additional questions? Senator Keel.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, make a statement and invite the department to respond if they want. I'm not trying to waylay anybody. It seems to me this program is fraught and the bill has some issues, and that this really isn't very popular. When I think when you average this out, you get 30-some of these happen a year over the 21-year history of the program, 38 maybe.
And when you compare that to the one other cabin program that wasn't mentioned in the earlier discussion because it's not staking, it's the one where, I forget the name of it, but it's the one where the department chooses land, subdivides it, plats it, records it, surveys it, and then through a couple of different sale mechanisms, an Alaskan can buy it. And you don't have a 14% failure rate like the staking program does. I think we sell on average 200 parcels a year through that one. That seems to be the program Alaskans are into. So I guess it seems to me, if you know, in keeping with the administration's goal to put more land in individual private ownership, that the productive approach, rather than invite endless reclassification applications and controversies about what's currently rec land or what might be habitat land, invite the possibility of future use of this program for non-cabin purposes, by, you know, removing the prove-up requirement. It seems to me the more productive approach would just be to put some money into more cabin subdivisions and sell them.
Ms. Colas, do you have a comment for that?
Sure. And Chair, Senator Keel.
Can I make a suggestion? There's obviously a different purpose for each of the programs. And I, although the senator may believe some of these programs are not popular, I will tell you I have participated in the staking programs. And if you have to work for a Friday, and that was the day it opened up, good luck on Saturday. I think they're extremely popular programs, depending on where they're located. So they may not be as popular in Southeast, but they're last one I remember actively attempting was Day Harbor, and you had to be on the ball because it happened quickly. So with that in mind, maybe perhaps you can describe the reason for the different types of programs and why some might be more attractive to than others.
Senator Michicki, and through the chair to Senator Keel. So yes, we have different programs, and I would say that it depends on what you're looking for. The subdivision sales that we have, you are gonna have a shared lot line. So you're gonna have that neighbor where the remote recreational sites are more remote. Most of them are not road access. Most of them you'd have to access through some other means, a plane, an ATV, a snow machine. And so that gives you a different experience than some of our remote rec or subdivision sites. And so plus those are auction. And so we have a minimum bid. People then make a bid. They don't know if their bid is going to be the highest or not for a parcel they may want. Sometimes they'll bid on multiple sites hoping that they'll get one. And so it really just depends on the locations of those. Some of those are more remote, but they're more expensive than some of our remote recreational cabin staking sites. And so the difference, I think, with this program that we're introducing today under SB 133, though, is the nomination piece, I think, is big. And I think we would have more success with individuals coming to us wanting to locate their recreational site in a specific area. And so that would give something that we don't currently have. I mean, you can nominate land, but I would say it's not at the same level as what this program would provide. This program would give us a solid path for those that are seeking the ability to establish a site, and not through just a lease and a sale, but also through a permit, similar to what our PUCP program has that is no longer available. So this would give a different flavor for recreation in the state of Alaska for residents seeking to be out on the land and maybe trying to figure out where they might want to purchase property, since, you know, going out to some of these areas is a bit daunting. So this would give another way for people to decide if it was a location they were interested in purchasing.
Does that help, Senator Keel?
Thank you, Ms. Chairman. I'll just note that it's a little incongruous to point to the necessity of staking and
for the more remote areas when you're, the bill in front of us removes any such requirement. So.
Okay, other questions? Take a brief at ease. For help on the bill today, with no more discussion, I would entertain a motion.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill Number 133, Version 32-GS1026/A, be moved from committee with attached committee fiscal notes and individual recommendation.
Any objections? Seeing none, Senate Bill 133, Version A is moved from committee with attached committee fiscal notes and individual recommendations. We take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Next, the committee will take up Senate Bill 229. This is the first time this bill is before the committee, so it's my intent to hear a brief presentation, the intent, some of the challenges that have been brought up. Then I understand the department submitted language for a committee substitute that would resolve some of the challenges identified in the bill. We will have the department explain those changes, look to the will of the committee on adopting the CS before taking public testimony and then setting the bill aside for members to further review. So here to present for Senate Bill 229, we have Ricky Geese, Department of Parks, DNR, Judy Bittner, Chief of the Office of History and Archaeology, DNR, and then here for questions, Casey Schroeder, and I think online is Chris Orman from Department of Labor. So with that, Mr. Geese, Ms. Bittner, please put yourselves on the record and begin when you're ready.
Good afternoon, members of the committee and Chairman Chickey. For the record, my name is Ricky Geese. I'm the director of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, the Department of Natural Resources through the Division of Parks Office of History and Archaeology is responsible for administering the programs in the Alaska Historic Preservation Act. We are here today to address SB 229, referred to as the Artifacts Bill. The bill amends the Alaska Historic Preservation Act and the Alaska Criminal Code to provide enhanced protections for historic artifacts through increased criminal penalty for violations of the Alaska Historic Preservation Act. A Class C felony has been added to the act as a penalty for a person who, without a permit, intentionally excavates artifacts from a site with the intent to sell. Other offenses of the Alaska Historic Preservation Act remain as a Class A misdemeanor. In addition, the bill amends the civil penalty section by adding a provision for restitution for damage and vandalized sites. And the goal is to protect and preserve Alaska's heritage resources. This bill will act as a deterrent for unauthorized actions. And with that, for more details, I would like to hand off to Judy Bittner, our section chief for the Office of History and Archaeology.
Ms. Bittner, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Judy Bittner. I am the chief history and archaeology, the office. Archaeology is in the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, Department of Natural Resources. Before you is a committee substitute, SB 229 version O. The committee substitute is the complete review of the bill. The primary intent of this bill is to enhance protection for historic and archaeological sites through increased penalties for violations of the Alaska Historic Preservation Act. Earlier versions of the bill relied on market value of artifacts to distinguish between a felony and a misdemeanor. Instead of market value of artifacts, this bill committee substitute focuses on violations of the Alaska Historic Preservation Act and the loss of scientific information caused by violations of the act, and also the intentional actions of the intent to sell artifacts. This orientation of the fits more closely with the policy of the Alaska Historic Preservation Act. The first sentence of the Alaska Act reads, "The policy of the state to preserve and protect the historic, prehistoric, and archaeological resources of Alaska from loss, desecration, and destruction, so the scientific, historic, and cultural heritage embodied in these resources may pass undiminished to future generations. Unauthorized excavation and damage to historic and archaeological resources destroys the context of the scientific information contained within that unique. Most of the information archaeologists recover from a site is in the stratigraphic position of artifacts and features. Also, the position of the artifact to another is critical to understanding a site. If a hearth with charcoal is found within a site, the charcoal can be dated. Artifacts associated with the hearth in a layer above or below the hearth can help date and define cultural eras. Unauthorized excavation in search of artifacts would dig right through a hearth feature. That information is lost forever once it is disturbed out of context. In the committee substitute, a distinction is made at the penalty level disturbance and the more casual surface collection artifacts. Removal of artifacts from a site without a permit with no ground or site disturbance is a misdemeanor. Intentional excavation, damage, destruction, or injury to a site is a Class C felony. All artifacts with the intent to sell is also a Class C felony. Also in the committee substitute is a provision added to the civil penalties section that allows for restitution for damaged or vandalized sites. Remediation or restoration of damaged sites can take place by order of the court. This completes my statement on the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Bittner. Questions? Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Ms. Bittner. So, I think of all the years of archaeologists coming to Alaska, various colleges and universities around the country, and many of our artifacts have wound up in very strange places around the world, actually. So help me understand what are authorized? How are universities or colleges or anthropologists, archaeologists, how are they authorized to do this work without damaging that scientific advancement that I'm sure we want as well.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, this is Judy Bittner. You get authorization through a permit. There's a state cultural resources permit that scientific or people, archaeologists, apply for a permit. And part of that permit is a research design and research questions. And so we, what kind of scientific information is going to be gathered through that excavation. And there is also a report. And also they must meet a professional qualification standards as well. And so it's through the permitting process that we control that.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Thank you, Ms. Ritter. So just help me understand now the materials found, say, native masks, even though someone has a permit and been authorized, does that material belong then to the state of Alaska? Can that be removed and taken to, I don't know, Ann Arbor or Paris? What happens to that material?
That material, through the chair to Senator Stevens, as part of the permit, there is a curation portion of it, and artifacts and materials removed from the state of Alaska belong to the state of Alaska, and we require that those artifacts be curated in a state repository. So those artifacts would go to the museum at the University of Alaska Fairbanks or the Alaska State Museum in Juneau for long-term management of those artifacts. And if someone wanted, an institution wanted to borrow or get possession of those artifacts on loan, they would deal with the museum institution.
Well, thank you, Ms. Pisner. I certainly appreciate your years of dedication to the state, and thank you for that.
Yeah, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thanks, Ms. Pisner, for being online. I did have a question just on the permit first. Is it, like when the university is doing research, archaeological research for a specific dig, is it an inclusive permit that says that anything within a certain area, or is it usually for a specific object?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, it's usually not an object, but a particular site, and the objects are part of that site. Information is gathered in the kind of the context of the site, and archaeology site is like a three-dimensional puzzle, and to be able to understand it, the artifacts are just one aspect of it. And what looking for is defined in their research design and their research question. So they have to have a purpose of that site answering certain questions. It might be subsistence practices. It might be the some other information about that area, that archaeology site, I think could enlighten with that. So there has to be a scientific purpose, and we, as part of the permitting process, there has to be a benefit to the state in terms of the information. So it has to be well-reasoned research, and that. So we have the discretion of turning down a request for a permit for the investigation of a particular, if we don't think they have a well thought out reason and research for excavating that site.
I got a couple more.
It has to be also public interest to have that information.
Thank you, Ms. Bittner. Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, just a couple more questions on that sort of line. When I was a Boy Scout, I was just thinking about this because I saw one of my Boy Scout friends. We were 13 years old. We were cruising down the Chena River about 40 miles, and it was a nice day out, and it was really slow moving, and we were lazy, so we weren't paddling. Clear water. Suddenly, I heard a splash behind me. The kid jumped out of his canoe, and he pulled up a mastodon tusk. It was probably it was big. It was huge, and it was heavy. Was that illegal?
Actually, yes. The Alaska Historic Preservation Act requires a permit to collect medical resources as well. And the mastodon tusks and other fossils found in mining. I really belong to the state and not the miner. It's hard to police, and sometimes when it is reported to us, what we do in those cases is just have them turn the fossil
it over to the state and provide information about the Alaska Conservation Act. That wouldn't be an intentional act. That's one that was done without knowledge of the Alaska Historic Preservation Act provisions.
And then just to follow up on the word intentionally, and I know there's an attorney here to maybe talk to us a little bit about that, but you mentioned placer miners. Placer miners from time to time come up. I mean, they just find these things, and they might intentionally, well, I don't know if it's intentional that they damage it, but it's intentional that they found something. Would they have to stop operations, or do they go through this self-reporting process to make sure that they're covered under the current statute?
They should, and I think it's in their, excuse me, through the chair to Senator Kalinowski, they should set it aside and report it to the Department of Natural Resources.
And then one last one, just finally, Mr. Chairman, is that has the current statute for criminal penalties ever been exercised in recent history that you know of?
Ms. Bittner?
Yes.
I'm sure you heard the question. Go ahead, please.
Oh, through the chair to Senator. I'm trying to think with the, we have had some joint exercises or enforcement activities with the federal agencies, and there was a recent one in Fairbanks where there were some artifacts that had been collected from state and federal lands that were I think recovered through a recently, just I think just last year. It's not very often, but it has happened.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
And I don't, Ms. Schroeder, I don't know if you want to come up to address any of these. You can just, no? Okay. So, Ms. Bittner, in the bill it says the Alaska Historic Preservation Act, currently the word artifact is not defined, but this bill defines artifact. Can you point me at that in this bill?
Actually, I think the... through the chair, this is through the chair. The current committee substitute does not have a definition of artifact because the I think it was felt that the definition of it's already covered in the definitions under historic, prehistoric, and archaeological resources, which includes deposit structures, ruins, sites, buildings, artifacts, fossils, and other objects of antiquity. Information pertaining to the historic culture of the people in the state, as well as natural history of the state, and it was felt that it was not needed.
Okay, we shouldn't talk about committee substitutes since we haven't gotten to that yet. Well, you said the current, okay. So I'm willing to hear a motion on the CS for Senate Bill 229. Mr. Vice Chair.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the CS for Senate Bill number 229, Resources Version 32-GS2541/O, be adopted as our working document.
Thank you, Senator. I will object for the purpose of discussion. Ms. Bittner, Director Geese, do you want to explain the changes, please? Do we have version O in front of us? Brief at ease. Explain the changes in the CS, please.
Mr. Chairman, this is... this is, for the record, Judy Bittner, and I can go through each section. if that's what you would desire.
Well, just the changes, but however you see it best.
Okay. Increases penalties for certain offenses involving artifacts and adds additional civil sanctions for those who violate the Alaska Historic Preservation Act. Section 1 amends unlawful acts section to make it a criminal felony for anyone without a permit to intentionally or destroy the historic, prehistoric, or archaeological resources. Section 2 amends the unlawful act section to make it a criminal felony for anyone to possess with the intent to sell or offer to sell a historic, prehistoric, or archaeological resources acquired in violation of the Alaska Historic Preservation Act. Section 3 adds 4 new subsections to the unlawful act section. Subsection E and F make it a criminal misdemeanor for anyone knowingly possess or remove a historic, prehistoric, or archaeological resource skin in violation of the Alaska Historic Preservation Act. Section D affirms that the offenses under Section 1 and 2 are Class C felonies. Section 8, knowingly and intentionally by referring to the definitions in the Alaska criminal statutes. 4, amend criminal penalties section to note that violations of the Alaska Historic Preservation Act not included in Section 1 and 2 are misdemeanors. Section 5 adds a new section that notes where the Alaska Historic Preservation Act statutes are silent on the mental health, the mental state for a criminal offense. The mental state will be determined based on AS 1181610B, which are statutes. Section 6 amends the civil penalties section by adding a provision for restitution for damaged or vandalized sites. The court can order remediation or restoration of historic, prehistoric, and archaeological sites that have been excavated, damaged, injured, or destroyed in violation of the Alaska Historic Preservation Act. Section 7 adds a section to the uncodified law consistent with state law that the criminal offenses and penalties provided in this act may be charged only at the effective date. And the effective date is July 2022. That concludes my statement.
Thank you, Ms. Bittner. Questions on the CS? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The CS dramatically broadens the number of things that are a felony as compared to the judiciary version of the bill. And we spent some time in judiciary. That's an overstatement. It somewhat significantly, maybe it's not dramatic, it expands the felonies. And I guess it would be good to get an explanation from the department of why it's necessary for it to be a felony to sell any historic or natural artifact, regardless of its value, if you know somebody got it without a permit. I think about... So certainly we all want to protect some of those phenomenally valuable historic sites, Alaska Native relics, maybe even a many feet long mastodon tusk of colossal value. But this is railroad ties and old tiles into the felony category. And I guess I'm curious why that is such an important thing as to back off the judiciary version.
Through the chair, this is Judy Bittner. I think the intent to sell and is trying to get at the behavior of the collecting and the destruction of the site. There's been a lot of find it on social media, people going out with their metal detectors and digging up sites. And it is really the kind of the process of getting those artifacts and then the selling of them. And it's the kind of the two behaviors together that destruction to Alaska's resources.
So I've got a couple of my own. I got to tell you, I need to understand this bill a lot better because I have my concerns. I'm afraid that my 12-year-old Lucy is going to go to prison for a long, long time. And it's not clear what we're doing here. We find stuff. Every Alaskan family has a little pile of things that they have found. And I want to know where this is. This feels very heavy-handed to me. So I certainly need a much better understanding. Or before I would want this bill to move anywhere, I would want it. It would have to be much clearer what we mean on how we're going to charge people for the different levels of different activities. And I hear what you're saying about damaging, defacing for fun, but know lots of outdoor families with lots of little piles of cool stuff, and I need to know where that differentiation lies. But Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I agree with you, Mr. Chairman. On the question I have is any historic? The term historic's used in a couple different sections of the bill itself, including the part that relates to the violation being a Class C felony. And I had a question about what's considered historic. I guess, the question about the railroad spikes that are at the old, it used to be railway between Kennecott, Coppermine, all the way to Cordova, had a lot of those railroad spikes, and you could find them all over the place. And some people did use metal detectors, I'm sure, to find some. Is that considered a historic? And would a person be in violation now if they were to find those spikes and take them?
Ms. Bittner?
Yes. Senator, through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, there's and criteria for defining what is a historic site that has been established by the Alaska Historical Commission. One applies that those criteria through a process of evaluation. Also within the Alaska statutes, it has a section in which the state gives title to all the artifacts, historic artifacts on its land. It has the title to historic artifacts, and so between the two of this historic site and what is a historically significant artifact, we'll go through a process of evaluation. An isolated, railroad spike or a historic item out of context is not really significant. However, if it is part of a larger site and contributes to that, yes, that is part of a historic site, and people need to leave it in place. And a lot of people, collect, and I think most families up here have their pile of artifacts on the hearth or in the garage or on display. Those are the kind of the casual kind of removal of artifacts. It's not really the intent of purpose of that. That would be we try to get at better stewardship of our historic places and try to get the people to learn to leave things in place and not collect on land. But what this is really getting at is the systematic destruction and excavation and looting and vandalism of sites with the intent to sell. And that is that we're trying to deter with this bill.
Okay. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I just want to make sure we're just not going overboard, because what comes to mind is the saying, one man's junk is another man's treasure. And if, using Senator Kawasaki's example, if someone has the fortitude to travel from Kennecott to Cordova and picks up railroad ties or anything that's been discarded for however many years, on one hand, I'd be like, thank you for cleaning up the junk that has been an eyesore on our land for decades. In addition to the Chilkoot Pass, we can't touch these rusty tin cans that someone ate soup out of however many years ago. Well, or Stella goes to jail.
Maybe Lucy. Going to jail anyway.
So it's just that I hope that we don't take this a little too far, because I understand what your point is. I mean, we don't want, you know, whether it's arrowheads or something, a mastodon or something along that line, but I don't know. I just don't want to go too far.
So, Ms. Bittner, to further clarify, I understand. Why is it that I can go right down the street here and purchase a mastodon tusk? Or I can purchase items made out of fossilized walrus and other ivory legally. Someone's finding it. They're not making new ones. Can you differentiate? Is that all from regional lands and not from state lands? Is that the difference?
Through the chair, this is Judy Bittner. It could be that it's not from state lands, but I think I could refer to a foreman with the Department of Law to be able to address this.
Okay. If you can please identify yourself for the record and perhaps explain. Mr. Orman.
Orman of Law and Natural Resources. I was just unmuted. Senator Machicki, this is Chris Foreman, Department of Law here in Juneau. You know, as far as the ability to purchase a mastodon tusk and that question, is that the one you've asked?
Well, that's one that yes, that's the current question.
Okay. I'm just making sure. As far as answering that question, you know, I think we would have to go back. We have to look at, you know, federal law, state law issues along in that regard. I think, though, to maybe answer where that question is coming from, I wanted to back up, if you may indulge me, and answer, I think, some of the questions that have come up through Senator Keel, Senator Kawasaki, regarding, I think, the CS, if that's okay. And then I think that will frame your question.
It may. Let's give it a shot, Mr. Orman.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Senator Machicki. So backing up just a little bit, when this bill was before the last committee, you know, one of the issues and one of the concerns was, and I know what was brought up was the idea that someone at Sandy Beach picking up something, and suddenly they're possessing, you know, an artifact and what that would mean. And I think we're hearing that question come up in different contexts here, whether it's mastodon tusk as you're floating a river and suddenly pick it up. The idea, I think, was looking at the current statutes and recognizing that under the current statutes, any violation of the Alaska Heritage Act would result in a misdemeanor or can yield a misdemeanor. So the idea was to start to differentiate some of the conduct. The other issue that came up, and I think that the big concern was the idea of removing artifacts with the intent to sell. So looking at kind of the general concepts and understanding a concern, I think, from OHA, so Judy Bettner and her office, about trying to value these items, that it would make a lot of sense to start to differentiate conduct. So if an individual intentionally starts to destroy a site, that's something we don't want to have happen. We don't want intentional excavation without a permit, and so to protect that. The idea of someone, you know, intentionally obtaining an object with the intent to turn on eBay and to turn a profit, that's something to avoid. I think the people that have something on their heart or that have picked things up or picked up railroad ties, while under the letter of the law, might be a misdemeanor, likely one, aren't going to be charged, and two, likely aren't going to satisfy either one of these provisions. These were added to I think, try to make it more egregious behavior and to serve as a general deterrent. So I think, and I understand, you know, I think the point, but when we start to, you know, Ms. Schroeder, who's in the audience, I believe she is, can discuss this. She's already told me this several times. You know, as far as under the current statutes, which allow for misdemeanors, the number of, I believe, cases that have been brought forward have been two. So there is a lot of discretion. There is a lot of consideration. I don't get the impression that this is going to be something that's going to yield a lot of crimes. The idea, hopefully, will be that it will serve as a general deterrent to the public that maybe reconsiders whether or not to, you know, start digging in a site without a permit. And furthermore, might help in those egregious situations, either with civil offenses, which is under 215, which would allow for restitution, remediation of a site that's improperly dug, excavated, those things. So now then, back to your, to the extent that some, you know, you can purchase in a Mastodon tusk, a lot of that's because process has been followed. Someone did obtain a permit. Someone did follow through the process and then was able, and either through federal law or state law, was able to then reach a point in which they could sell it. So it's not as if that individual that's down there is selling something because they obtained it in violation of either this act, meaning the Alaska Heritage Act, or did so in violation of federal law. They've complied with state law and federal law and then are able to then properly sell it. Really long-winded way, but I hope, Senator Machicki, that I provided a little bit of background and was helpful.
Yes, I thank you. Thank you for that, Mr. Orman. I think that is helpful. It doesn't necessarily, the fact that it's still a misdemeanor for a five-year-old to pick up an old bolt on Sandy Beach is still absurd. But maybe that's something we need to look at in this bill. Maybe perhaps there needs to be sites that were deemed as historic before enforcement. Because if we're talking about finding ancient native site, that's one thing. If we're talking about finding a bolt on Sandy Beach, those are not related. And maybe this is the bill where we look at that and make it so that it is no longer a misdemeanor to find that bolt or that railroad spike that may be uncovered one day and never to be seen again. I spent a lot of time outside and we like finding stuff. And wading in the waters of Cook Inlet and finding a hollowed out stone that at some point may have been an oil lamp that will never be seen again if it's not picked up is a very different thing than walking into an obvious established native historic site and prying a carving off the rock. So I just think we're going to have to put some thought into this. It's not nearly as simple. What you're asking us to do, and I could be wrong here, but you, what you seem to be asking us to do is forget the absurdity of the minor part of this and really focus on the potentially egregious. And that's hard to do because I'm not sure the line is that clear. Yes, Senator Stevens.
Yes, well, it's very complex, and my mind keeps going. It's going to the native artifacts. That only goes back 50,000 years. We've also got fossils that go back God knows how long. But what you said, I think, is that it all focuses around intent to sell. So there's no violation that appears if people find something and find a a fossil at Fossil Beach in Kodiak that is constantly falling off, and they take it home. There's nothing wrong with that. But the problem are the violation occurs if they intend to sell it. Do I have that right?
Senator Stevens, this is Chris Foreman through the chair. I think that's correct, and I think something just to focus on, and I don't want to step on Ms. Schroeder's shoes, but she'll probably tell you I'm a former prosecutor, so I may do it anyway, is that mental state is really important here. The individual that picked up something at Sandy Beach or picked up the bowl, I think it's highly unlikely they're going to satisfy knowingly. And as far as, intent to sell, which then makes it a felony, or intent to, to deface the site and excavate a site improperly, I think that's a mental state that's going to be hard to meet and to satisfy. I can imagine that law enforcement, if suddenly there was a request to review an offense of a five-year-old picking up a bolt on the beach, is going to find that knowingly certainly hasn't been met. So to answer your question correct, I think the mental states and the specific conduct pursuant to the mental states is what avoids kind of some of the legally avoids the potential, and with all due deference, the potential for some of the potential absurd outcomes that I understand you all are concerned with, and I get that.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're at 5 o'clock. We're not doing anything with this bill today. Is there any further questions? If not, we have no one. I don't know that we need to do public testimony today. I brief at ease. We have the CS is a working document. It's before us. We have no more discussion. We're going to move on to public testimony. Public testimony on Senate Bill 229 is now open. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 229, including the Department of Law person who obviously would rather not discuss the bill today? Okay.
Could we invite Lucy to speak?
Yeah, no, I feel like we might be incriminating me. Is there anyone online who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 229? Okay, seeing no public testimony at this bill, public testimony is now closed. We will set this bill aside for consideration during a future committee hearing. There's been some joking, but I'm actually quite serious about every Alaskan's family pile of things, and then knowingly, now that we know, Senator Keel.
Just real briefly,
yes.
The objection to adopting our working document is still pending, so we may want to.
I remove my objection. Is there any further objection to adopting the CS for Senate Bill 229? Seeing none, thank you for catching that, Senator. So the CS for Senate Bill 229 is before us. Any other questions? Thanks for all your hard work and attention today, as well as the presenters, LAO support staff, and Senate pages. Our next meeting is Wednesday, April 27th, where we will review Senate Bill 230, Trapping Cabins, Fee for Construction, and Senate Bill 227, State Ownership of Submerged Land. This meeting is adjourned at 5:04 p.m.